All right, here we go. All right, this interview is being conducted on April 2nd, 1993 with David Weese, who was a crew member aboard the Coast Guard C-130 aircraft 1600, which on July 30th, 1982, crashed into a mountainside on Atu Island.
Contact MST office. Duty Officer Hernandez, contact MST office.
All right, Dave, first question is, how'd you get interested in aviation?
I'd always liked planes and flying and knew people that got in the, that were in the Coast Guard, they were with ships, but I wanted to be in the aviation field, and a friend of mine told me that they did have guaranteed aviation schools, and it took me about 6 months talking to recruiters, and they finally agreed to give me a guaranteed aviation school. So I went to boot camp and then to East City to AM school, and left there 1st of August, 1980, and came up to Kodiak, Alaska.
So that's how you got interested in Alaska, or did they just send you?
I just got orders to Alaska.
So you didn't have did you have any ambitions of coming up here? I mean, what did you think of it when you first?
At first, it was like, yeah, Alaska. And I liked it when I got up here because I liked to hunt and fish. I'm from Montana originally, so the wasn't really a big change for me.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. Okay. Let me ask you another question. The day of the plane crash, you know, how did day start out? I mean,
got up around 6 o'clock in the morning and met at the galley to have some breakfast. Go out to the plane, get it ready to go. We're going to take just mail and a few things over to Attu and then come back in Shimia and pick up a USO group that we had out there, and we just left them there, and the Air Force was going to load all their instruments and baggage and stuff up on the pallet, so we just come back and load it up and go with them. And we had one woman that was going to go over to Attu and stay to do a college course on Alaska and that over there, and we got ready to go, and the weather was marginal and foggy and drizzly.
Yeah.
And
typical day out at the chain.
Yeah. Yeah. And we just got the plane started and headed over there, and I had the older APN 59 radar, which is basically a pretty good radar for land. Mm-hmm. And everything, and I was the loadmaster on the plane. There was a scanner in the left seat that was just training, and drop master was in the right-hand seat in the SAR bin, and I was sitting in the seat pallet right behind the SAR bin.
Okay, so you had a seat pallet? You only have one seat pallet?
One seat pallet.
Plus the SAR bin.
Right.
And was the troop seats down, or? Because I know you guys were hauling some packs, so it was just...
Just a seat pallet. There was enough room just in the seat pallet. We only taken three people over to Attu, two that were going to be stationed in, and the woman from a college in California.
Mm. Hmm. So you got going over that way. So the day was nothing special. No. Now you were on there. It was an RON, wasn't it? Or
yeah, we'd been out on Attu log and brought the USO group, spent Thursday night there in Shimia.
Mm-hmm.
And we're getting ready to come back to Kodiak Friday. We're just going to stop, pick the USO group up, and fly direct back to Kodiak.
All right, so then after the crash, after the plane, what was your first cue that something was wrong?
Well, I was on and off headset because I didn't have to be, and they were going to do the before landing safety check, so I was in the back in the pallet anyway, so I just got up to look at everything, and I was getting ready to sit back down in my seat in the seat pallet, and I just heard the engine spool up, and I was like, I knew something was wrong because I'd never heard that before. And then I remember them pulling up and the nose coming up, and that threw me back in my seat, so I never had a chance to get strapped in.
Mm, I know.
And next thing I remember is hitting, and I was going forward into the backside of the SAR bin.
So then, was the weather bad to cause this, or?
They had, it was fog right down to the ground, and it might have made a difference because we were in the wrong bay, and we were up a little bit higher, and the fog was right to the ground there. It may have been up enough over at the airport, it may have been up enough to get in, mm-hmm. but since we were up in the mountains where we shouldn't have been, it was right down to the deck.
Mm. So, okay, so then after the part where you went into the to the SAR bin, what's the next thing you remember after that?
Some of it I remember, some I don't, because when I went through into the SAR bin, I basically hit my head pretty good and mm-hmm. knocked myself out. And but I could still remember hearing voices and everything else. And I remember hearing Mr. Shear's voice yelling at me to keep rolling, because I guess I was rolling away from the flames.
Hmm.
And I'm not sure where I got out, but basically, from what we can figure, when the plane came apart at the 245, the SAR bin came out and everything came out behind it, so I just came out through the hole in the front of the airplane. And a lot of the flames stayed behind us because the wings snapped off when we hit the ground. And then we slid forward and the wings and the fuel stayed behind us. So most of the flames and fire were behind us, and it was starting, everything was starting to catch on fire, and Mr. Shear was telling me to keep rolling and keep rolling. And I rolled down the hill a ways, and I guess one of the other guys said that I was doing okay, so they just left me there so they'd get the rest of the guys out of the plane. And I was sitting on part of the tail that was broken off. I was just sitting there looking around at everything, and I had numerous lacerations of my face and my arms and legs, and I'd either when the pallets came together or my weight going into the SAR bin, my leg was in front of me or something, and I crushed my ankle and mm-hmm. snapped it, and it came out through the side of my flight boot.
So Mr. Shear, he was the pilot?
Co-pilot.
He was the co-pilot on the flight. Okay.
And Mr. White was the pilot.
Okay. And were they, Mr. White being in the left seat, the pilot seat, and Mr. Shear in the right seat, the co-pilot seat. You say the 245 bulkhead, you're talking about the first beam there where the airplane is.
Yeah, right in front of the scanner windows okay. or something. It just came apart around there.
Okay. So where it separates the front of the plane from the back of the plane, right? What about the rescue operation that went on? I heard that there was a...
I guess the guys at the station there at two, they heard us, they knew we were coming in, they heard the plane go overhead, and they...
Wing Walkers.
We were just leaving.
Bay 4. Wing Walkers, Bay 4, 1714.
Figured lots we were just leaving, and because of the fog and weather.
Oh, okay.
And they just went back inside, and they never heard us crash or heard anything from the station, even though it was probably about 4 miles away is all.
And they didn't see anything, no planes or
nothing.
Hear nothing, huh?
And then they picked up the ELT over at Chimia, and they called that too to see if we'd landed over there, and they said no, they had went overhead and we heard them, but we never saw them again. And they figured we'd landed in the water at first.
Mm.
And the Mellon was like right in between Shimmy and Attu, and they had the 52 on the back of it, and 52 took off. The from what I had heard, the weather was so bad that the captain of the boat has authorization over the helicopter letting it go or not go. He knew what was going on, so he was like, well, I'm going to my cabin, I can't hear anything there, so you guys do what you want to do.
Wow.
That way he couldn't get in trouble, but
yeah.
He wanted the helo to go. And they took off, and they started doing a sweep back and forth on the water up to Attu, didn't find anything. Then when we got to Attu, they started stair-stepping up the hills. And all of a sudden they saw the wreckage and the flames and everything through the fog. And they landed there, got everybody together, the most critically injured to begin with, and put them in litters and put them in the back of the 52. They had the navigator, the radioman, the drop master, myself, and Mr. Shear, helicopter on the first trip out of there. The only crewman that was in the helicopter was the pilot. Everybody else stayed behind with the rest of the people. And the 52 had been flying for so long looking for us, because it took a little over 6 hours for them from when we crashed to when they picked us up. And they had to stop back at the ship, refuel, and then head us back to Shimmia.
So did they take you via the boat to Shimmia, or did they, okay.
Yeah, they stopped on boat, and just fueled the helicopter real quick, and then took us to Shimmia. And they'd already told Shimmia that they had found us and that we had crashed and that they needed all emergency stuff. And they had a medical KC-135 out of Fairbanks was en route to Shimmia. And they brought Coast Guard 130 from Kodiak out to Shimmia. They had Dr. Nemeroff on it.
Oh, yeah.
And they brought, the crew was comprised of people that knew people on the plane. So they could tell, you know, if they're really out of it or how bad they're doing, somebody to talk to that they know. And they had Dave Osborne was the one I knew. And he said he was talking to me there in the ops center in Shimmia where they had us until the 135 got there. And he said I was pretty messed up because my whole face was black and blue and I was in and out of it. And I had neck brace on, the inflatable cast on my leg. And he said they were taking care of us real good, and they had, most of us were on morphine or something for the pain, and the 135 got there, and they loaded us into that, and flew us into Anchorage, Delmendorf, to the hospital there. The navigator was burned pretty good, and he'd also broken his back, and they lost him, I think, three times en route to Anchorage, and they resuscitated and brought him back to life.
Hmm. So during that 6 hours, that by the time, you know, when you crashed, to the time that you were picked up by the helicopter, what did everyone do for survival?
The ones that could move around and get things, they got anything they could find. The rafts come out of the wings, so they had the rafts. I think they had one of the survival sleds made it out of the plane.
Hmm.
And anything they could find that was usable, insulation that was laying around from the plane or anything like that, they used and just tried bundling us up as good as we could, or use the raft for a wind blockage, and basically just all huddled together and stayed there to keep warm until somebody could find us. Didn't have a lot of stuff for first aid or anything. They just, whatever they could find that they were wrapping around wounds and stuff like that. I was, with my open fracture and my lacerations in my head, I was bleeding pretty good. I'd lost a little over 3 pints of blood when they picked us up.
So, I guess the weather, you said it was foggy out there.
Yeah, it was foggy and misty, and temperatures probably 40, 45 degrees, something in that area.
Yeah, it's still pretty chilly. Heck yeah, it's chilly. So yourself and I guess the engineer were pretty bad, badly cut up and all, right?
Yeah. Sabota could still walk around and everything, but he had broke his arm, and he had tied, I can't remember, but he had tied it up with something just to hold it in place, and he was able to move around and kind of help people and that, because the radio and navigator were both pretty well off because they had broken their backs, and also the navigator got burned bad, and so they were really trying to take care of him because he was basically the worst shape.
Now that it, you know, you look back, it's been what, almost 10 years now, going on 10 years. What do you think about, what would you do differently if, I mean, if it was going again and you were in the same kind of a situation? Before you were in the back of the airplane, now that you're being up front, being able to see things, anything different about, have you ever thought about that? I mean, now that you're up front,
yeah.
Vice that, what maybe?
Well, I was talking with Sabota and Shear and everything else, because Shear didn't feel right about where they were at before we crashed. He just sensed something was wrong, that they were in the wrong place. And he had told the pilot to pull up and turn left a couple times. And finally the co-pilot took control of the airplane and slapped his hands out of there and pulled up and turned left. And if he wouldn't have done that, we would have hit nose first right into the hill. And since he had done that, we bellied in instead. But being up front now, if you don't feel comfortable or something like that, you know, you can force them to or push the issue more to get out of there, you know.
Right, right, yeah, I understand what you mean. Sorry about that. So when you were getting ready to land, when you were set up for the, you were configured to land at two, so that means your gear was down and your flaps were down. So you were all set. And obviously with all that down, your speed is somewhat slower too.
Yeah.
If that wasn't down, if your gear wasn't down, you weren't in a landing configuration, do you think that maybe you'd been better off or worse off if you'd have been clean, vice dirty?
I think we were better off with the gear down. Things I'd read from Lockheed, they said that the gear absorbed a lot of the impact shock. If we would have been gear up, we just would have crushed in the belly and everything. But the gear absorbed a lot of the shock for the first impact. It drove jack screws right into the ground, about 2.5 feet.
Yeah, looking at those pictures, remember those pictures that you gave me? I was looking through those, and it's amazing just to look at those pictures and just to see actually anyone survive that crash.
That's what Lockheed said.
You know, pieces and parts strewn all over the landscape there. I don't know. But, everything, you know, that you've gone through and you've done and, has it turned you against Alaska? Has it, done anything like that? Because, you know, being up in Kodiak here, or even just in Alaska, not necessarily Kodiak, but the terrain is so mountainous, and you've got the temperatures are so cold and everything else. And it's flat. Now we'll redo this again. Again, like Clearwater being flat, even in Elizabeth City, it's flat. You know, in Sacramento, where the weather is nice and your flying is generally routine, right?
the only thing they have down there, you got to worry about thunderstorms.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and I've been down there, and I guess you've been other places down here, right?
Yeah, East City and Clearwater.
Okay, so in both those places, flying down there, and comparing that to Alaska's flying, I guess the question really is, where would you rather be flying? Would you rather be flying down there, or would you rather be flying up there?
I like to fly in both places, really. I like it up here because of the scenery and seeing different things and stuff like that most people don't ever get to see. I'm flying over top of volcanoes and looking down the side of them. Down there, you get to go a lot of nice places down in the Bahamas and stuff like that. That's different too. You can go snorkeling or scuba diving in places, but there's things in each place that offset each other.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, like myself, I like it up here. I mean, I like the flying up here, but I'm old. The way the weather is, you know, and especially like that day there. Ever since that crash, I've always been a little more. I don't know what the real word is, but I've been a little more cautious about what's going on when I'm flying. It made me be aware, more aware. Has that done that to you too? I mean, since then?
Since I've been up here, I've been here almost 3 years. I've told a couple pilots that I don't feel safe what we're doing. Let's get out of here and go out in the open somewhere and think about this again.
Mm-hmm. So then, just to go back a little bit, after you were in Shimia and after you've been taken off of Attu Island, of course, and being in Shimia and getting ready to go to Anchorage, you had probably a couple hour flight to Anchorage. That's where they brought you to from Shimia, right?
Yeah.
What were you thinking then? I mean, you know, what were you?
I guess they had me so doped up and everything. Basically, I slept all the way because I remember the bits and pieces here and there, and then remember getting off the plane at Anchorage and putting us in ambulance, taking us over to the hospital, and then they went and x-rayed me from head to toe and went into surgery. And after I got done with surgery, I was out for another. I went into surgery at 4 a.m. in the morning on the Saturday morning, and this happened 8 a.m. Friday morning. So it was 16 hours from when I crashed till I got to the operating room. And then they put me in intensive care, and I woke up and started remembering everything again Sunday at 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
Okay, you're married. You have what, one?
One.
One kid. I can imagine what your wife was thinking when she got the word that you were in this plane crash. What does she feel about back up here now and you're flying up here? Is she nervous about it? Or is
no.
She, no?
No. It's a different one anyway.
Oh. Okay, well, obviously she knows about everything.
Yeah.
And I mean, she knows that, you know, all the problems. Okay. And she doesn't feel...
No.
That, okay.
She likes it up here too, and we've extended for a year to stay up here another year longer.
Okay, so you really do like it then. Right. Well, I understand that. I've spent 5 years up here the last time I was here, so... But it does make you think. I mean, it really does. It does me, you know. And because I was in route to Kodiak the first time when I heard.
Yeah, because I remember meeting you there in the hospital in Anchorage.
Yeah. So I was kind of. Made me think. Well, is there anything else that you'd like to say or want to talk about? Does it bother you to talk about it now?
No.
You know.
Because that's when I got down to East City. And since it was the first C-130 the Coast Guard ever lost, and
yeah.
I got to East City, and everybody was like asking me questions here and there, and so they had asked me one time, said, just to clear this all up, get it over with one time, said, do you mind getting up in front of the air station at a meeting and just letting them ask you questions about it? And I said, no, it doesn't bother me at all. So that way everybody got to ask their questions and find out what was going on and what happened and stuff like that. And I kept in contact with one of the guys pretty real good, and the other ones I always saw or asked about and stuff that were on the plane crash. I've seen all but a couple of the people that were on the plane crash, and they're all doing good. Three of us are still in the Coast Guard flying that were on that plane. I've seen the navigator, and he's in a wheelchair. He's doing good, though, and he, from his burns and everything, he lost part of his fingers, and they figured he was going to be paralyzed from the neck down, but he's paralyzed from the waist down. The radioman, he is walking again. They did some operations on his back and reconstruction, and he's walking again. And the drop master, he broke both ankles.
Now, he was strapped in, right? He was sitting down in the light scanner seat?
Yeah, he, instinct to brace yourself, he'd put his legs up on the 245. So he, impact coming into that, his weight and everything broke his ankles. And I broke my ankles, did my one ankle, cracked 5 vertebrae in my back, and numerous lacerations.
And, okay, you said earlier, too, that there were some passengers on board, too.
one of the seamen that was going out to Abtu, he died in the plane crash and in the fire. The other guy that was going out to Shimia, or I mean to Abtu, he broke his arm or something, and the woman, she broke her ankle or cracked her ankle. She was basically in pretty good shape, really.
Now, they were all in the seat pallet, and
yeah.
They were all strapped in,
yeah.
And everything.
The one that died, he was sitting in the seat pallet directly behind me, and he got trapped in the seat pallet from parts of the airplane, from the overhead and everything else, and it was on fire. No one could get to it.
No, I didn't realize that either. And there's a lot of things I didn't realize about that crash. The I know the like you said earlier, the weather being 45 degrees or 40 degrees, and it's foggy and kind of light rain and everything. Waiting around for 6 hours, trying to keep warm, trying to keep people together. That in itself is especially being in Alaska like that, where you have the that kind of weather and that kind of conditions, it's got to be tough. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. I mean, again, if this were to happen down someplace else, you know, where you wouldn't have to worry about the weather conditions, it would probably be a lot easier on people.
Yeah, because it'd be a lot warmer and stuff.
Right.
You wouldn't have to worry about hypothermia setting in as much, or in down somewhere in the States.
And was that a big concern of you guys there, too? I mean,
basically, most of us did have hypothermia.
Some form or
yeah.
Another? I mean, whether it be a mild case. Was that the extent of the hypothermia? Was it just mild? I mean, your body temperature
dropped. Body temperature dropped a few degrees. They were, mine dropped about 4 degrees. Mine was partially because of lack of blood.
Right.
I didn't have enough to keep warm with my blood loss.
Right.
So mine was more severe than most of the people's.
4 degrees. That's a good that's a good drop in temperature for a body.
I don't know if my normal temperature, you know, your normal temperature is like 98.6.
Right.
Mine's like 97.8.
Oh, is that right? So it's low anyway.
Mine's low. I don't know if it's because of that or anything, but mine is always like half a degree low.
So let's see. I know the pilot is since retired.
White retired?
Yeah, he's retired.
That's
now.
Right. He retired.
I think he's back in Sacramento. be truthful. And Scheer,
George Scheer from Mark Air over in Anchorage.
Right. Yeah, you know, I haven't seen him since that.
I saw him last summer with Mr. Holmeshoe down here. We were going out fishing.
Oh, is that right? So, yeah, he used to live like right behind me downtown. So I knew him pretty well. And then Ken Sloboda, the flight engineer, he's out in Borinken now.
Yeah.
You know, I saw him not too long ago. He seems to be doing well.
Yeah. Mark Crocker, his E-City.
Now, was he back up here?
Yeah. When I got up here in 1980, Crocker was here, Sloboda was here.
Right. But has he come back since the accident? Do you remember? I thought Crocker had come back up. Maybe not.
Yeah, because, well, Crocker left after the accident, went to Cape Cod, started flying helicopters, crashed in a helicopter, and then came back up to Kodiak and started flying 130s again.
Wow. Stay away from him. Man. People with one crash is bad, and to have two of them, my goodness. Well, I don't know. I think I've got all the questions, really.
Okay.
Well, is there anything else that you want to say that has come to mind?
Nothing I can think of.
I appreciate you coming in and taking the time to go through this with me. And what I'm going to do is I'll go ahead and make a transcription of this. And when I get that done, I'll give you a copy of that, and I'll try to make a copy of this tape. That shouldn't be a problem. And I'll give you a copy of that.
Okay.
And we'll see how it goes. Again, Dave, I really do appreciate you taking the time to do this.
No problem.
I know that if it was mine, I mean, if it was me that was in that crash, I'm not sure that I'd be so easy to speak about it. I don't know. It's good that there are people like you that can do that, and tell other people.
It makes
people.
It a lot easier talking about it than...
Yeah.
Holding everything or letting things bother you about it.
Right. Oh, yeah, I agree. I agree wholeheartedly.
But if you want to use those pictures, too, or anything for the class, just let me know.
Okay, I'll do that. I may do that. I'm not sure if... you have negatives?
No.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I'm going to stop this thing. I can put this all together and subtract from it. But that was one thing I wanted to ask about, too. I mean, I asked about, about the wife and the kids and all. I know that you're pretty close to the family, and I forgot. I wanted to ask you about your family, your mother and your father,
They had kind of goofed things up. I mean, I know there's a lot of things going on that something happens like that. They had mixed me up with Craig Michaels as the navigator when they talked to my parents. And...
Who mixed it up? You mean the...
Whoever had called my parents from the command here.
Oh, listen.
And about an hour later or something, they called back again, and the captain called them and apologized and told them that I was in critical condition, but I was going to make it. And... They didn't come up to the hospital from Montana, but if I would have been any worse or anything like that, they would have been up. But they had said that I was fine, that I just had a crushed leg, and I was going to be fine after that. But as soon as I got done with out of the hospital and everything, I went home on leave anyway.
Mm. So you went back down to Montana?
Yeah. But... my parents were, very wondering and how is he and how everything's going to be and...
Heck yeah.
Friends of my parents and stuff like that were... I got letters from everybody and phone calls and some of the people that we know had said, he'll probably quit flying now. And my dad was like, no, he'll never quit flying.
Mm. Yeah, it takes a lot to get back into that plane after having a crash like that or ending up in the hospital because of one.
It was 9 months before I got back in an airplane. That's not of my wanting, but they wouldn't let me back in until my back healed and my leg and everything else.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. That makes sense. I'll tell you what, I don't know. But, you know, I go through that album. I keep thinking about that album that you've got on, you know, the one that you let me look at, of all the pictures and all that, you know. And I, every so often I look, I flash back in my mind and I look at it and I think, damn, I just don't understand how.
Do you remember the old black man out in Shimia that always bought toasties?
The mayor?
The garbage guy or whatever?
Yeah.
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 I saw him about 3 months ago out there. He remembered who I was.
Oh, is that right?
And he gave me a few more pieces of paper and articles and stuff on the plane crash that he had collected.
Hmm. So you've added that to your collection also, huh? So I know you've got a, you know, you've got a pretty in-depth collection there, and then you've got that cassette, that VCR cassette of that. And do you take it out and look at it once in a while? I mean, do you kind of?
Yeah, every once in a while. It's.
What do you think about when you do look at it?
It's like, you know, it's hard to believe that I'm still alive after this, and makes you think a lot.
Yeah, I guess it does. Makes me think just to look through there, you know. You guys were pretty lucky, and most of you just walked away from it.
Yeah.
Yep, that's more than I wanna go through, I think. I hope we never have another one. I hope it's a lot is learned from what happened that day.
I'm sure there is.
We do different things now than we did in them days. I mean, the approaches into Attu, for instance, are different.
Yeah.
Now with I don't know if this radar is really any improvement over the 215. Well, it probably is, but just the minimums have changed because of what happened with that that plane, the 1600. Our approach into Attu has changed because of what happened. And I think I hope the attitude has changed because of what happened too.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
There's, you know, if there's no reason to get in there to try to kill yourself getting in there.
Bring soda
nothing's,
and...
nothing's that important.
That's right. And I agree. I think most people now have adopted that. I hope they have. I mean, the people I've flown with have done that anyways. So, you know, well, there are other places we go into that are problems too.
Yeah.
You know, Juneau is a real bad problem. You've been in there. Yeah, you've been in there. Just about anywhere we fly in Alaska. Even coming back in here to Kodiak.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, how many times have we had to go to Anchorage because of the weather being so poor? I know you've spent many nights over there.
I spent more time there in the last week than I've been here.
Yeah. Well, I couldn't get in not too long ago either for 2 days, I guess, on a southeast log I went on. You know, no way to get in
yeah.
At all. Go home. And I think that some of that has come out of that crash, too. I mean, people are more reluctant. Hopefully, they're more reluctant to break minimums, you know, even though we know it happens, but you never can tell. Well, Dave, again, I want to thank you for
no
taking
problem.
The time to come out, go through this with me, and again, I'll make copies of this
okay.
for you.